Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, and we're delighted to have you here at the New York Public Library for this evening's program, which I'm sure will be terrific. Before I introduce tonight's speakers, I'd like to thank the co-sponsor of the event, the Museum of American Finance, and we are all extremely grateful to Betsy Bradley, the Deputy Director of the Cullman Center, for her excellent work in organizing this program and bringing all the elements together to make it work. Thank you, Betsy. We have two remaining events in the Cullman Center's Conversation from the Cullman Center, that was redundant, this spring. The first is a musical theater piece by graphic novelist and former Cullman Center fellow Ben Ketcher and the composer Mark Mulcahy called A Check Room Romance. That event is actually sold out, so I shouldn't really be announcing it, but it's got two performances, and there might be tickets at the door. They're really fabulous performances, so if you feel like taking a chance, you should come to the door on the 13th and the 15th and try. On May 27th, another former Cullman Center fellow, the novelist Danzy Senna, will be talking about her beautifully written, gripping new nonfiction book about growing up in an interracial family called Where Did You Sleep Last Night? She'll be talking with the writer, Rebecca Walker. You'll find flyers with information about this program, actually both programs, on the table by the exit, or where you just came in, by the entrance, and also a sign-up sheet in case you're not already on our email list and would like to know about our upcoming programs for next year, for instance. Tonight's conversation, as you know, since you're here, will be about T.J. Styles' superb new book, about Cornelius Vanderbilt, the first tycoon. Speaking of superb, the reviews of this book have been fabulous. Perhaps some of you saw the one in yesterday's New York Times. It called the book a mighty and mighty confident work, one that moves with force and conviction and imperious wit through Vanderbilt's noisy life and times. This is state-of-the-art biography. The review referred to the book a couple of times as The Last Tycoon, which no doubt pleased the ghost of F. Scott Fitzgerald, but maybe not TJ's publishers. The paper ran a correction today, actually. TJ worked on this monumental book, the Times called it Whacking, while he was a fellow at the Cullman Center in 2004, 2005, and he found many treasures in the New York Public Library's manuscripts division. If you didn't stop to look at the wonderful one-night-only exhibition of some of the materials TJ found here in the case on the north side of the room right over there, you should definitely take a look before you leave. It's really interesting. There are letters to and from Vanderbilt, members of his family, Samuel Tilden, Horace Greeley, and lots of others. Special thanks to TJ and William Stingone, the library's curator of manuscripts, and to Miriam D'Artani, the exhibition's conservator, for selecting and setting up this unique small exhibition. The Boston Globe ran another eminently quotable review of the first tycoon. I have to hesitate. First, last. Styles has painted a full-bodied, nuanced picture of the man. Elegance of style, no pun intended, I'm sure. Elegance of style and fair-minded intent illuminate Styles' latest expectedly profound exploration of American culture in the raw. Expectedly profound because Styles' previous book, Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War, established him as an author from whom we can expect both first-rate writing and first-rate history, which is what we really at the Cullman Center want to promote. Which brings me to the man who will be, first-rate writing and first-rate history, brings me to the man who will be interviewing TJ tonight, the best-selling novelist Kevin Baker. Paradise Alley, the middle volume in Baker's trilogy of historical novels set in New York, won the James Fenimore Cooper Prize for Best Historical Fiction from the Society of American Historians in 2003. The final volume, Stryver's Row, set in Harlem in the 1940s, came out in 2006. Pete Hamill in the New York Times called it a brave, honorable work, taking us into a vanished world that should be better known. More important, Baker imagines his human subjects with a sense of pity and compassion and embrace, thus making them visible in ways that are fresh and new. These two writers have a great deal in common and a great deal to talk about, and I won't take up another second of their time, except to say that that they'll talk for about 45 minutes and then take questions and answers, and you will be able to buy both the first Tycoon, which I should have held up before, and Strivers Row at a table just outside these doors as you leave. Since the authors are going to need to get out there, please don't come up and throng them and ask questions here. You can ask your questions out there. Now, I won't take up another second.
Thank you. Yes, no thronging, please. thanks so much, Jean. Thanks for coming, everyone, to this evening. It's a pleasure to be here at the library and the Coleman Center, which has once again succeeded in bringing to publication an outstanding work of literature. The first Tycoon takes its place this year as the biography of record of one of the greatest and most neglected figures in American business history. Cornelius Vanderbilt's career in shipping, railroads, and finance spanned an incredible epoch in the industrial development of this nation, from the very beginnings of steam-powered transportation to the tying together of the entire North American continent in a steel web of rail. As T.J. Stiles writes, few 19th century businessmen equaled Vanderbilt in his impact on American history. And of those who did, arguably none proved to be so influential at so fundamental a level over a period so formative or so long. Born in 1794, the Commodore lived to be 82 and played a significant role in so many of the leading events in his tumultuous life. From the very beginnings of steamboat travel on the Hudson River to the seminal Supreme Court case, Gibbons v. Ogden, establishing the federal government's right to regulate interstate commerce and destroying the remnants of feudal culture in America, to transatlantic travel, the California Gold Rush, and the growth of the United States into a continental nation, the start of travel across Central America and the planting of the seed that was to become the Panama Canal, the crushing of the notorious American filibuster, William Walker, in his attempt to abscond with the country of Nicaragua, the destruction of the Confederate ironclad Merrimack, and the safeguarding of the Union's gold shipments, both of which played a seminal part in winning the Civil War, the fabled stock manipulations of the Erie Railroad and the birth of the modern corporation, the consolidation of the great New York rail lines into the enormous New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, the growth of New York City into the first city of America, and a major world hub of finance and trade, complete with its first Grand Central Station. Vanderbilt played a major part in all of these events and more. As Stiles writes, the Commodore's life left its mark on Americans' most basic beliefs about equality and opportunity. He started in business as the very epitome of the Jacksonian ideal, the working man desiring only a level playing field to compete against the vested interests. He ended it as a symbol of inequality and monopoly in the Gilded Age, one who made Americans question for the first time the dangers of gigantism in business. He was instrumental in acquainting Americans with the very idea of the modern corporation, of an enormous depersonalized business entity. When Cornelius Vanderbilt was a young man, Americans worked almost exclusively as farmers and small businessmen, and what money they saw was mostly solid coin. Corporations were a rarity. Entities of limited duration formed mostly to complete large public projects, such as roads or canals, before being disbanded. By the time Vanderbilt died, Americans had been introduced to paper money and stocks and bonds and even more abstract representations of wealth, even if they were still uneasy about it, getting more uneasy all the time. Vanderbilt's own life served as an epic within the epoch. He started out as a teenage farm boy with a few years of grade school education, sailing a homemade ferry across New York Harbor from Staten Island. By the time of his death, he was estimated to be the second richest man in America, with a fortune of roughly $100 million. To give you an idea of what that meant, Stiles writes that if Vanderbilt had somehow been able to liquidate his entire estate, he would have received one out of every $9 then in circulation. By way of comparison, if Bill Gates, worth $57 billion at the height of his pre-crash wealth in September 2008, had been able to liquidate all of his estate, he would have been entitled to one out of every $138 then in circulation. He did not come by this money easily. Vanderbilt was a tough, capable, and stunningly intelligent man, and his life was one of almost constant competition. He fought in almost every arena then available, from fistfights on the New York docks to racing his steamboats up the Hudson, to filing and defending himself in countless lawsuits, to battling for the business of dozens of steamship and rail lines that ran from Connecticut to California, London to Panama, to launching endless coups on Wall Street and in corporate boardrooms, to whipping his prized trotters on against his fellow sportsmen along the upper reaches of what was then the Bloomingdale Road. Contests that went on at least two occasions in his old age left him pitched out headfirst on the road in what looked to be fatal accidents. He was a hard man who was hard on those around him, including a wife he seems to have driven to a sanitarium, sons-in-laws who served as his personal minions but who felt the need to constantly prove their worth lest they be thrown over, daughters who snubbed his second wife and bitterly contested his will, a son who suffered a nervous breakdown and put up with all manner of insults from him to win his confidence and his place as his successor, and two more sons who lived tragic lives and never did gain his approval. He was also a man capable of love, of great works of charity in the last years of his life, and even of sentiment, as witnessed by his repeated attempts to contact old friends and loved ones through seances. It is both a great personal and a public story, and T.J. Stiles has done a magnificent job of guiding us through a life crowded with events and with a wonderfully named, a wonderfully colorful supporting cast full of such Dickensian names as James Banker, Henry Clews, George Law, Fernando Wood, Frank Work, Salmon Chase, Daniel Drew, Big Jim Fisk, Jay Gould, Emily Thorne, Amasa Stone, Curtis Peck, Tennessee Claflin, Victoria Woodhull, Erastus Corning, Ponciano Corral, Chauncey Depew, Horace Greeley, A. Oakey Hall, Augustus Shell, John Preen, Azariah Booty, Orondates Moran, am I pronouncing that
right? That's right.
Orondates Moran, and Horace Clark, to name just a few. In short, it's a terrific read. So James Parton once wrote of the young Thomas Jefferson that, along with his command of 5 foreign languages, he could calculate an eclipse, survey an estate, tie an artery, plan an edifice, try a cause, break a horse, dance a minuet, and play the violin. In the same vein, one could say that Cornelius Vanderbilt could design a steamship, sail it over open ocean and jungle rapids, race a champion horse, run a shipping line, consolidate a railroad, short a stock, raid a corporation, lobby a president, build a rail depot, found a university, and raise an army.
And all before lunchtime.
That's right. just this juxtaposition of skills, I think, says a great deal about what America became in Vanderbilt's time and who ran it. But I think also in view of what's gone on in the country's economy and on Wall Street over the last few months, viewing General Motors' amended plan for its own rescue, for example, in which it actually revised the miles per gallon as future cars are expected to get downward. Anyone seeing that and comparing these executives with their bonuses for going bankrupt, I think is tempted to look at a Vanderbilt or a Morgan or a Carnegie or a Henry Ford and ask, what happened? How did we go from that to this?
Well, I'm going to do what presidential candidates do at debates and first okay. Say thank you for having me here. As Gene mentioned, I was a fellow at the Cullman Center, and it was an incredible experience without which my book wouldn't have been possible. And so thanks very much to the staff, including the manuscripts department, a lot of whom are here, to do such superb work. So just want to make that very important thank you. That difference, that transition, is visible during Vanderbilt's life. And one thing I point out, that Vanderbilt himself was both a pioneer paving the way toward the corporate future, and also in some ways a representative of an older business world. He was sort of the merchant prince of the Medici mold, as I put it. And by creating this huge corporation, the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, it was, I think, in many ways the kind of pioneer of the giant depersonalized corporations we've been talking about. But his primary rival for largest and most important corporation was the Pennsylvania Railroad. One of the 4 primary railroads in the country after the Civil War, called the trunk lines. And the Pennsylvania Railroad is very interesting because its managers represent very much kind of the modern model of management. And their managers were Andrew Carnegie's mentors, Thomas A. Scott, who was superintendent, then vice president, then president of the railroad, and J. Edgar Thomson. And Vanderbilt was someone who purchased a controlling share of the stock in the corporation, moved into management, and then what he would do is he would not take a salary. He would take only remuneration through dividends on his stocks. And this is, of course, a model we've moved away from. Now we expect stocks, shares to grow in value. There's still some stocks that, of course, that pay dividends, but that's not the primary interest. At that time, it was the primary thing investors looked for, steady return every year in dividends. So Vanderbilt would, he had to make his railroads pay. He had to make it profitable year in, year out for him to get any money out of them. By contrast, the Pennsylvania Railroad, they also paid dividends fairly successfully up to a point.
And this is, by the way, this is how, just to explain, this is how mostly how stocks worked at the time, mm-hmm. that you mostly paid dividends. It wasn't, you weren't, investors weren't so concerned with the stock going up and down, just making sure it paid the...
Exactly. So prices tended to fluctuate, but you didn't see steady and ever-increasing growth. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that would have been fishy to people. They would have thought there was manipulation going on. And so the Pennsylvania Railroad had these professional managers who were not majority shareholders. And what they did is they did things to make money out of the railroad on the side. They were pioneers of the Shell Corporation. Thomas A. Scott was famous in one case for he was so politically influential that he got a bill through the Pennsylvania legislature and got the governor to sign it 34 minutes after it was introduced. So they were very powerful, and they would use their political influence to set up these shell corporations, and they would funnel their railroad's business through these corporations, which they controlled, and in many ways like this, they would funnel money out of the company. And they ran it fairly well up to a point, but when the panic of 1873 hit, their railroad had to stop paying dividends, and the shareholders finally began to look into what they were doing. Vanderbilt's railroads continued to pay dividends throughout the panic. As he put it, he ran his corporations like they were his private personal property. And so how did we get here? You see that origins of that within Vanderbilt's lifetime, that separation of management from ownership, and owners, the shareholders, who aren't really paying attention. And then that creates an incentive for the agents who are running the company to start to engage in stuff on the side and not to be looking over the toward the long-term health of the company. Now, you know, it's an incentive. It doesn't guarantee malfeasance, but you see right. that origin.
Whereas Vanderbilt seems to have always been amazingly hands-on.
I think that's true. And, you know, at the end of his life, much less so. During his, you know, when he was a railroad chief, and he actually testified before a state legislative committee. They said, are you a practical manager? You know, are you somebody who's out setting timetables and, you know, inspecting the locomotives? He said, no, I don't manage anything. And that's not entirely true, because when he thought something was wrong, all of a sudden he was on top of it.
Right.
And people felt his wrath, of which he always had an abundance. But for the most part, when he got to the railroad years, he relinquished operational control. But he always had that eye. Someone was always watching.
And interestingly, always, it seems, able to outcompete other lines, whether on steamships or on railroads, always had that certain genius for seeing how expenses could be cut and customers could be lured away.
It's not a very sexy subject, but that's a consistent trait that you see in successful managers, the most successful of the so-called robber barons. Andrew Carnegie's a great example, Rockefeller. They cut costs. And they were more successful than their rivals at cutting costs. And Vanderbilt once said, if he couldn't run a steamship or a railroad for 20% less than the guy who ran it before him or somebody running alongside him, then he'd just close up business and go out of business.
And in fact, near the end of the book, when you have the start of the Grange and these populist movements from out west who have a huge complaint against the railroad, which is that they're this preferential and often secret pricing system, mm-hmm. where they're moving some people's goods for free. And Vanderbilt's asked for it, and he says, basically, fine. We'd be happy to compete on an equal basis. You know, it's just no problem with them in that.
Yeah, what they're saying is they were complaining about that special legislation that, like Thomas A. Scott would get passed, and others, the railroads would get special laws passed in certain states. And Vanderbilt, so Vanderbilt's response to that complaint was, yeah, sure, great. As long as the laws are the same for everybody, I'm on board.
Yeah.
I can do, as long as the rules are the same, I can beat anyone, is his attitude.
So in that sense, in what was a very rough and tumble business time with few defined business or public ethics, he really, you get the sense he really was something of an honorable man in a sense, or had at least like something of his own sense of honor in how you conducted business.
Yeah, that's a really interesting trait of his, because his business peers had this sort of love-hate is the wrong way to put it, sort of respect-hate. I don't think anyone loved him who was in business with him. But, you know, one of the reasons why the book is longer than it might have been is, you know, I tried to write more than a business story. You know, it's about the making of modern American culture. And, you know, you alluded in your comments to the end of sort of the traces of feudalism or the culture of deference that was held over in the 19th century for a while from the 18th century. And in Vanderbilt's very first years in steamboats, I found these letters from these old gentry families saying, they're undercutting prices, this is scandalous. Have you ever heard of anything so scandalous?
Yes,
they're cutting prices, competition, this is awful.
Yeah.
And the idea of an individualistic competitive economy where it was basically no holds barred was this major cultural shift. And actually, Gordon Wood talks about this in The Radicalism of the American Revolution, that business wasn't just business, it was changing American culture. The idea of individualism and competitiveness was a huge shift, and Vanderbilt was very much in the forefront. But meanwhile, there was a new code of honor that was emerging, and it was sort of like the good sportsmanship, almost, in a way.
Yeah.
And rather than, we're all gentlemen, so let's cut deals with each other, which they did do also, but it's a long story, read the book. But the new code was more about, rather than a gentlemanly code, it was kind of like a fair fight code.
Right.
And he very much stuck to that. And he would say, I found letters here in the library with someone saying, you know, I sent for Vanderbilt and said, we made a deal and I wanted it in writing. He said, no, you know that my word is as good as my bond. And it was very important to him to develop that reputation.
And it's interesting, as you say, because you have all these, what was fair might be putting your ferry boat across the pier so their guy's ferry boat couldn't dock.
Yes.
It might tearing up or burning down the other guy's ferry station might be okay. These really crazy races down, and one thing that's outside the purview of the book, but there's that insane race between the Henry Clay and the other steamship down the Hudson, which lasts all day. Amazingly, you know, wild race. They're just basically throwing people off the boat at their stops and barely pausing to take them on because they're racing each other. And at the end of this, the Henry Clay's boiler explodes and it kills like 150 people or something right up outside of Yonkers. You know, this was basic commuter transportation at the time. As if like rival subway trains were racing each other down the
road. It's very true. And not only that, but it was a spectator sport.
Yeah.
That it really mattered to people that they were on the fastest boat.
I mean, many of them were cheering it on. The ones who weren't panicked and hanging out for dear life were cheering on their steamboat.
Yeah, there were sort of two sets of passengers, the one who were really excited about the racing and the ones who insisted on being towed in a barge behind the boat so that they wouldn't be close to the boiler when it exploded.
Yeah, that was one image in your book. And it just, but that was, all of that was, you know, sort of in a kind of constantly reworked and, you know, sense of honor. That was okay. But then, you know, and all these people end up really respecting the Commodore who were fighting him to the death for steamship lines and rail lines. But then you get down to Jay Gould and Big Jim Fisk, who he seems to have just hated, you know, and who a lot of people seem to have hated. Mm-hmm. And because they stepped over the whole bounds.
Well, that's interesting, too, in the sense that, you know, you go from this early era of... you know, steamboats, for a lot of business reasons, really were very competition-oriented business because steamboats weren't that expensive as big pieces of capital, physical capital. They weren't that expensive. You know, a small group of people could get together and build one. And, you know, you could move it between markets. You know, if you were competing for a while and you either won or lost, you could just take it somewhere else. And one of my favorite examples of that era is that's in the book is in 1838, the Staten Island ferry owner ordered his captain of his ferry to ram a rival ferry and sink it. And I found these court accounts from people who were on that ferry, and it was just unbelievable.
And he almost did. He
almost sank it.
Yeah.
And the passengers on the other ferry, when they got to Staten Island, they ripped down the ferry house and nearly murdered the captain, the president of the. Unbelievable. So then you get to the railroad era. And what's different about railroads? They're fixed pieces of infrastructure. So you could have a price war, but what's going to happen at the end? You have to come to some sort of terms because the other guy is still there. And due to the nature of railroads, because they were so capital intensive and they had such a large workforce, that even if you had no business at all, you're running hardly any trains, your fixed expenses from just maintaining and having the railroad were enormously high, and they didn't go up very much when you started to run more and more trains. So a railroad that was in bad shape would cut prices. Even if they were losing money, it was better than losing even more money from not having the business. So railroads, they're stuck. There's an incentive to undercut prices. And so Vanderbilt takes part in something that had started before his time, which is gentlemen's agreements. He goes, what you had in early America under the culture of deference reappears because of business logic, where you have these cartels. And they had elaborate cartels where they had commissions, and they would hire a commissioner who could fire people from individual railroads who were undercutting prices. And at the same time, curiously, Vanderbilt himself, by the end of his life, is rising in social stature. And so he has he's taken on a business that is sort of inclined toward gentlemanly agreements because of the nature of the business. And he himself is becoming more and more gentlemanly himself. Yeah. He, toward the end of his life, his personality, his demeanor, was much more refined than it was when he was a young steamboat captain. It's kind of a curious parallel in business, personal and business parallel. And then Jay Gould and Jim Fisk come along, brash young upstarts, and they are doing things like telling about secret deals to the press. They are deliberately trying to insult and demean the Commodore. And he became sort of obsessed with them. Even though their railroad, the Erie, was never in much of a position to do him a lot of harm, it became this kind of famous rivalry in the American press between these businessmen.
And they actually start just printing, right, stock certificates. They get a printing press and start printing stock certificates without anything behind them.
Yes.
I mean, just pure larceny. You
know? Yeah.
They somehow avoid, they flee to New Jersey, right, at some point, but they avoid actual jail time over this somehow.
Yeah, it was there were strict laws that regulated how much you could how many shares you could issue of a company, and this is something that I don't need to go into up on stage, but it has to do with the whole kind of cultural ferment around the rise of securities, and people really felt that stock a share of stock represented $100 worth of fixed capital. It was represented something tangible and real. So when you increase the number of shares without building new physical infrastructure, it was widely seen by even the most intellectual figures as fraud. And so when Vanderbilt got in a business fight with Gould and Fisk and Daniel Drew over the Erie Railway, they started, and he was trying to corner the market in their shares, so they just started printing shares like crazy. And it was, you know, very famous episode where Vanderbilt got a judge to issue arrest warrants. Here they are, they're officers of one of the leading, largest corporations in America, scampering onto a ferry and racing away from the police with literally bales of greenbacks in stock. And, you know, they set up shop in what they called Fort Taylor. And
over in New Jersey.
Over in New Jersey, yes. And the Garden State welcomed them and made them a corporation in New Jersey. And so to try to settle the matter, Jay Gould literally went to Albany with a suitcase full of cash. And there are some hilarious figures from the New York State Legislature who they could see both sides of the issue depending on
how much cash was being passed around.
How big the
around.
Suitcase was. And it finally, Vanderbilt actually miraculously managed to force them to pay back a lot of what he had lost. But it's an incredible episode.
And he never kind of never forgave them for it, although he would try to contact Big Jim Fisk in seances, right?
Yes, that was, yeah. What my favorite example of that. About the time of the Civil War is when Vanderbilt starts to go to seances. And as I point out in the book, this is actually the high point of spiritualism in American life. And the Civil War, the better part of 1 million people died. And so people started to go to mediums all the time to contact the dead. And I don't think Vanderbilt definitely did it. I don't think he, though, drew any business base any business decisions on these seances. And not only because he continued to be successful, I personally don't believe in spiritualism, so I don't think the mediums actually were contacting the dead. So I think that they were saying a lot of nonsense when they would conjure up the ghosts. And Vanderbilt clued into that too, even though he still went to seances. So there's a great incident that you're referring to where he called up the ghost of Jim Fisk after Fisk had been shot by the rival for a mistress and shot dead. So Fisk comes up and Vanderbilt asks him a few questions about stock. And of course the answers made no sense at all. Vanderbilt said, "What are you talking about?" You know, he goes, "Okay, all right, we'll see who's right, you or me." And he's arguing with the ghost of Jim Fisk. And then they start to joke with each other. He says, "So how do you like it on the other side?" And Fisk says, "Well, you'll find out soon enough. You're at the end of your line." And so it's a hilarious incident. And it shows, though, I think that he found comfort with seances, but I don't think he based any decisions on them.
Yeah.
But that rivalry, there's a quote that I never found a good source for it, for Vanderbilt saying it, like so many of Vanderbilt's quotes. But it's still one of my favorites because it does summarize his attitude toward Jay Gould. He supposedly said, "It never pays to kick a skunk."
Yeah.
And I never, unfortunately, I wish I could document it. I couldn't document it, so I left it out of the book. I'll just tell you now. Because it was his attitude toward Jay Gould.
Yeah, a good attitude to have.
Yeah. And though in the end, I have to say, he actually, in the most important battles, he either held his own or came off a little better with Jay Gould. But Jay Gould managed to embarrass him, which is one of the reasons why he was so embittered about him. For example, during one rate war, the Erie Railway under Jay Gould and Jim Fisk cut the price of cattle cars from the West, radically undercut them. So of course the New York Central Railroad follows. Then they cut further. Finally, the New York Central Railroad went from, I don't know, $150 a car for cattle to $1 a car. So meanwhile, secretly, Jay Gould and Jim Fisk were buying thousands of heads of cattle out in Chicago, and they're shipping it over the New York Central for almost nothing. And then once they did it, they made a loud announcement to the press.
Yeah.
They couldn't just make a profit, they had to embarrass Vanderbilt. Yeah. So, you know, it's actually in business, it was a trivial dispute. But it was that kind of getting under his skin that just drove him nuts. And by contrast, I mean, this is something we talked about before. With other businessmen, they would have vicious fights, and then they would end up being friends afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of not personal, Sonny, it's business, you know. And it's funny, too, because that story inadvertently shows the whole span of Vanderbilt's life, in that he's one of the people he's competing against this whole time, is Daniel Drew, this other notorious character, who is supposedly, and probably not true, but started watering stock by, you know, started off his career driving literal stock into New York. That's how you got beef to market in the early 19th century. He drove it down there, and he would supposedly feed it lots of salt and then water it at the collect pond, which is where, you know, the courthouses are now in downtown, this huge pond then. And he would drive the cattle down there. They would drink up water and go on. And that was filled in, became the Five Points. The whole city grew up around here. And by the end of his career, he's fighting these wars over transporting, you know, cattle by the thousands or the millions from halfway across the country. And this is all the, you know, the change that the railroads have brought. But to talk about another skunk for a moment, William Walker, who was what was called a filibuster, nothing to do with the senatorial maneuver, but at the time referred to kind of a freebooter, somebody who would go down and try to take over a country. And it was quite a rash of these in the 1840s and 50s, Americans who decided to go down with often a handful of mercenaries and maybe start fighting in a civil war in a Latin American country and then try to take it over. And this was considered a great thing by kind of Southern and Confederate-leaning individuals who thought that this would be a natural field to expand slavery in.
Well, especially in the case of Cuba, which was, after the fall of the Spanish Empire in Latin America, of course, Cuba remained the star, the jewel of the Spanish overseas possessions. And there was large-scale slavery there already, and there were a lot of Cubans who were fighting very hard for independence as well. And there was also a large Cuban population in New York, which my classmate Alessandro Perez is writing about. And Cuba especially, the Southerners who were looking to expand slavery were fascinated with. But Walker, who was ended up landing in San Francisco, he invaded Mexico unsuccessfully, with a handful of men. And then he got a contract to fight for one side in the Nicaraguan Civil War. So he sailed off with 56 men to fight for one side in Nicaragua's almost perpetual civil war. And Nicaragua was a country where two times in Vanderbilt's career life, he made radical changes in his career. And the California Gold Rush was the first of these, where he'd been involved in steamboat lines radiating out of New York through the Northeast. And then when the Gold Rush started, he abruptly got out of that and went into transatlantic and California-bound steamships. And the main route of commerce and for much of the migration was by steamship down to Panama, crossing at Panama, up to another steamship on the Pacific. And Vanderbilt started a rival line across Nicaragua, tried to build a canal, couldn't get funding. And they would carry people across the waterways of Nicaragua by boat and short land crossing. Very successful. He sold out, went on a grand tour of Europe, engaged in various other affairs. Then he started to buy control of this company, the Accessory Transit Company, once again. At the very moment when he was doing that, Walker sailed off to Nicaragua by luck. He was a terrible general.
You have a great description. His generalship usually consisted of just ordering frontal attacks against completely well dug in positions.
Yeah, and which reflected, you know, the filibuster attitude, the North American attitude toward Latin America was, you know, we're Americans, so we're one of us is worth 10 of them. So even though he's dug in, you know, behind fortified walls and he has a rifle, well, you know, don't worry, you're Americans, go get them, go. and fortunately, once he, by luck, really, he carries out one maneuver, by luck, he manages to win. By luck, the leading general and the head of state for his side die, and he ends up being the strongman. Can't even speak Spanish. And he's the strongman in Nicaragua. And thousands of Americans, you know, who are excited by the success, start coming down or want to come down to join him. And meanwhile, this is a story which completely overturns the whole presumptions about how this story played out, with papers I found here in legal papers that a lawyer has in the here in the manuscripts department. Most people said, well, you know, Vanderbilt's rivals within the company knew he was taking control, so they convinced Walker, give us control of the rights for carrying passengers, and then we'll bring free reinforcements, and then Vanderbilt realized he was betrayed. In fact, a friend of Walker's went to the San Francisco agent of the company, Cornelius Garrison, who one of the guys who ends up betraying Vanderbilt, and says, look, you know, your company is going to be destroyed. He said, well, how do you know? Well, Walker's my friend. I'm going to tell him to destroy it. And I think, you know, he's going to give the rights to me, I think. And I don't have any ships. You do. I'll sell the rights to you. And there was this hilarious exchange where Garrison said, well, you know, I couldn't do anything against the company. But, you know, if they fall, I really don't want to fall with them, so okay. And this whole story plays out with these political, corrupt political figures, these self-interested characters who are woven through, you know, the 1850s especially. It was like a part of American culture. It was political corruption, and Walker carried it off to Nicaragua. And so anyway, so Walker does this, gives the rights to Vanderbilt's enemies, who become his enemies. And Vanderbilt tries to get the, you know, they destroy this company as Vanderbilt buys control of it again. And Vanderbilt unsuccessfully tried to get the U.S. government and the British to intervene. They don't want to help for various reasons.
And Walker's doing all these things, like he brings back slavery in Nicaragua.
Yeah,
you know, just a horrible...
Unbelievable. And he had no interest in annexing Nicaragua to the U.S. He had these Napoleonic visions that he would conquer all of Latin America. So needless to say, the neighbors of Nicaragua got a little worried about him. And so Vanderbilt carried out this private foreign policy. He started negotiating with the neighbors, sent off. He found this this guy who had been acquitted of murdering his captain when he was a first mate, was acquitted because no one saw him do it. He went into the captain's cabin, came out. The captain had been bludgeoned to death, but no one saw him do it. So, and he had worked in Nicaragua, so Vanderbilt sent him off to Costa Rica with a crate of gold and a bunch of rifles. And he led a commando raid that, some wonderful scenes, that seized all these steamboats and cut off Walker from his reinforcements. And it really is, it's something out of a Conrad novel. It's just remarkable.
Or Marquez. And is this one American, Scott, I think, who's down there.
Captain Scott.
Captain Scott. And Vanderbilt owes him money from something. So because of this, he's obstructing everything Vanderbilt's doing or refusing to hand over these ships. He's just kind of holding out. And finally, Vanderbilt pays him back. So
the entire war, the thousands of people would have lived if Vanderbilt sent down a guy initially who said, tell Scott that I own the company, you know, take control of the steamboats. The British had a fleet there. They would have protected the steamboats from Walker. And it would have just cut everything off almost at the beginning. And this local guy who Vanderbilt had hired when he was 17 years old and the very first steamboat Vanderbilt captain, the local guy says, hell no, I'm owed $17,000 by the company. Until I'm paid, I'm not cooperating. So as a result, this entire international war involving five countries plays out. And then later, when Vanderbilt's, you know, they win the war and Vanderbilt sends down a guy again to try to take control of the steamboats, and he chases him off the boats with a revolver saying, you know, I'm going to shoot you unless you pay me. And this one little unknown character, because of his personal debt that hasn't been paid, ends up changing the history of about four or five countries.
He almost seems Vanderbilt like himself.
Yeah, but Vanderbilt hires him in the end.
I mean, it really would have been probably most logical for the canal to go through Nicaragua too, from in terms of the waterways available there. But
it seems that way. I mean, I don't know the later history of what happened. I do know that one of the consequences of this entire episode, in which William Walker, this North American, takes over Nicaragua, reinstitutes slavery, is that what Vanderbilt found when he tried to get the business going again. Okay, so he won the war. The Nicaraguans, they would walk up to the line of allowing him to once again carry passengers across Nicaragua, and then they said, you know what, we just can't accept the idea of North Americans coming in large numbers again. Yeah.